Welcome to the Masters of Engineering podcast, cool products, the people who develop them, and how they do it. I'm John Hirschtick, co-founder and CEO of Onshape. I've spent my life building CAD and other software tools for product design, but the best part of my job is that I get to meet some of the coolest product developers in the world. And in this podcast, you get to meet them too. Now, my guest today is Sarah Giblin of Riot, R-I-U-T, that's riut.co.uk. Sarah makes backpacks. She's the founder, CEO, and I believe the only employee of Riot. She makes bags and backpacks that are really special. They're secure, and they're unlike any others in the world. She has an amazing story. I know you're going to love hearing about her backpacks, her background, and how she does design. And she's probably the only guest I'll ever have on this podcast who has no formal training in product design or development and no experience in product design and development before founding her company. Sarah, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, John. It's great to be here.
Yeah, great to have you. And so you make some, there's lots of backpacks and bags in this world. Yours are very special and secure. Can you tell us about them, please?
So I've used a backpack my entire life, and one day, I'm sure we'll come to why that is, I decided to start making backpacks and start making them exactly the opposite way round to all other backpacks that exist, because I worked out one day that the person behind you can actually get into your backpack more easily than you can when you wear a conventional backpack. So that was the problem that I came across in my completely normal life. Just like I was working in an office job in the financial services and just doing a lot of traveling with a backpack.
So you're working in this unrelated industry, and you told me when we met at the Develop 3D live show in the UK, fantastic show, by the way, which I enjoy going to. Big shout out to our friends at Develop 3D for putting on an excellent event. So Sarah, you came up to me after one of my talks or something, we were talking, and you told me the story. Can you tell me a little more about that moment on the airplane?
Oh, yeah. So I was getting off an airplane, and you know how when everyone's in an airplane, there's just enough space for the human beings sitting in their seats. But as you get off the plane, you pull down all your luggage, and there's just absolutely not enough space for everyone's luggage and the humans in the little aisleway to get out. So there was a little bit of stoppage as we were leaving the plane. And what happened was the guy in front of me, who had his backpack on his back, seemed really distressed at how close I was to his backpack. And I could tell from his, you know, everything about his body movement, his body language, that he wasn't happy that I was so close, but there was very little that I could do about it. And at one point, I sort of got pushed into his bag, and he looked at me, took his backpack off, unzipped that sort of nice little pocket on the outside of his bag, took out his passport, took out his wallet, shoved them in his pockets, zipped back his bag again, and put it back on his back. And he sort of looked at me in a sort of, now my stuff's safe kind of way. And I thought, you don't really think I'm going to steal anything from your backpack, do you? We're all just trying to get home. And I was just sort of mulling over this when there was another heave of people from the back of the plane. And the guy behind me suddenly got really close to my backpack. And I found myself reacting in exactly the same way, thinking, oh my God, is my wallet still there? Is my passport still there? Are my keys safe? And then I suddenly thought, wait a second, is there a chance that everyone in the world who is wearing a backpack right now is worried about what is going on behind their back and is actually worried that someone is trying to take something out of their backpack, when in fact that person isn't trying to take anything from their backpack? They're worried about who is going to take something out of their backpack. And I just imagined this endless queue of everyone in the world with backpacks worrying about what was going on. And I thought, whoa, okay, I need to stop. I'm going to go home and buy a backpack that has no zips on the outside. They're all against your back, and I'm just going to get that so I never have to worry about it again.
You said you were going to go home and buy such a backpack. So what happened? Did you find one for sale?
Oh, right. So I started Googling it, and I was like, right, come on, you know, you can do this. Just Google it and buy it. And Honestly, that evening I was quite tired. I thought, wow, I'm so tired, I don't even know how to use Google anymore. I can't find this backpack, and I don't even know how to describe it really. So I left it a few days, and it sort of came back every so often because I was traveling so much. So I was Googling it, trying to find it, and at one point I was like, how do I even describe this thing that's in my head? Like, is it a backpack with no zips? No, it's got zips, they're just in a different place. And I was sort of, making my way through all of these searches. And then at one point, I was like, okay, fine, let me try this safe backpack. And all that came up online was this huge traveler's backpack that had a net around it and a padlock through the net. And I was like, wow, this is just so not what I'm looking for. Honestly, I just went back to getting on with my life. I was going to work every day, traveling a lot. I was moving between London and Berlin and traveling for work as well. And because I was traveling so much, this idea just didn't leave me. And in fact, I found myself sketching it just to make sure that I wasn't going completely crazy. And after about 6 months, maybe a little bit longer, I hadn't mentioned it to anyone. And then one morning at breakfast with my friends, I said, guys, I just need to get this out of my brain. I think all backpacks might be the wrong way around. And they were just like, Sarah, what are you talking about? Come on, tell us. I was like, I mean, this can't be true, but I think at least for city people, is it genuinely possible that the person behind you can get into your backpack more easily than you can? And they were like, maybe. I said, what happens if you turn it around? What happens if you turn it around? Zips off the outside, just put them against your back so that when you're wearing it, your back naturally protects the zips. And that was the moment, really. That was when I managed to put it into words for the first time. And one of my friends actually said, Sarah, you should really go and do that. And I was like, I've got a job, thanks. I'm totally fine. Never manufactured or designed anything in my life. I don't think this is a good idea. I just wanted to let you know I'd had this funny idea. I was really trying to amuse my friends more than anything. But honestly, from that conversation onwards, that really led to where I am now.
Wow. So great point. I never thought about that. When you're wearing a traditional backpack, the person behind you has easier access to your goods than others. And by the way, in my personal life, I've had the experience. I went to Paris last summer to visit my daughter, and she said to me, Dad, be really careful on the subway because there's this rash of crime where people are breaking into backpacks and taking people's phones and wallets out of their backpacks while in the subway. And so, very real problem and very surprising. So you couldn't find one, even a badly designed one that was similar.
No.
And you decide with no background in product development, you're going to build your own. So, okay, so what you have this job and and so what happens next? What do you do?
Right. So I started sketching this idea out and thinking, how do you make a company? How do you make a backpack? Where can you make this sort of thing? What does it actually require? And what I was doing was sketching it the whole time just to make sure that I hadn't made some massive error in my head. Because it did seem like it was a little bit too easy once the idea was there.
Sarah, can you elaborate a bit when you say sketching on paper, right? Not software. Paper and pencil and color and black and white.
Literally a gray pencil on any paper I could find. Like when I look back at my notebooks, anything that really from about 2014 onwards, it's just covered in riot bag designs. Every little, even my train tickets, even my plane tickets, they're just covered in them. And I was just sketching it out and beginning to work out what a supply chain would look like. That was what was really important to me because I realized I didn't just want to make this for myself. I could sort of see that this was going to be something that could actually work for pretty much any city commuter in the world. So I didn't want to just make it for me. I wanted to make it for other people. And for me, the design was pretty much set in my head at that point. And that wasn't really where the design development took place. What I needed to do to leave my job was to put a bit of a supply chain together. understand how that would work, how the manufacturing side and the distribution side would work, then save up enough money to be able to survive for a year. I gave myself a year to be able to make the Riot Bag profitable. And when I saved up that money, I left straight away, actually. So I handed in my resignation and had nothing but my sketches of this idea. And the next day, I jumped on the train and started visiting prototyping companies in the UK. And there are a couple that were around that would do textile products.
Okay,
So I,
can I just interrupt
yeah,
you
go
just a
on.
moment? I just want to go back this moment in time. You're leaving your job with no background in product development, and you saved up money for a year. Did you have any thoughts about trying to recruit other people as co-founders or raise money? Did you think, hey, maybe I'll get an investor, or did you not even try either of those things?
What I really wanted to focus on initially was completing a prototype before I got too far down the road. So I didn't want to talk to investors. I didn't really want to talk to anyone until this idea that I was so convinced was actually going to make sense in reality. I just wanted to get the prototype started and done as quickly as possible. And what became clear to me as I was in that process was, okay, I've got enough money to survive for a year, but I don't have enough money to start this company. And I was reading a lot about, I was actually reading a couple of business books. One was The Art of the Start by Guy Kawasaki, who was at Apple in the 80s as their marketing guy. And I was also reading about crowdfunding online. And so that was in the back of my head as being the way that I was going to finance it. So I was really just doing one step at a time, following a bit of Guy Kawasaki's advice, which was don't write a business plan, prototype, make your prototype and finish it. And then once you know that this thing is going to work, think about everything else. And I was quite happy with that. So I got prototyping in that I started working with an actual design company who were, they wanted to offer me lots of advice, but the way we ended up working was that I had my drawings and we went basically straight from the drawings to making a paper version to making a fabric version. And we had three different prototypes. One just to, really thin material, just to make sure that this backpack, which is like a closed shell, actually works. And as soon as I saw it with a zip in and with straps in, I could just see it totally works. It completely works. Whilst I had been drawing all of these bags, I had actually forgotten that backpacks have straps. So I don't know whether anyone else can relate to that. So the straps did worry me for a little while, but it turned out it was fine. Prototype number three, I was in a race against time. So I really pushed the designer I was working with, Anna Legg. She was really brilliant. And I remember looking at the final prototype and going, that is what I had in my head. And when I had that, I just raced with it. I took it to be photographed. I made a video about it and I went straight onto Kickstarter. And I really had just told my closest friends and a couple of family members. My family were pretty worried about this new development in my career that I had given up my job in financial services, which was pretty secure and, well paid to go and do backpacks.
I can imagine, and I actually have to say, I like a lot of our listeners who are entrepreneurs, know the feeling of everyone looking at you like you're crazy, but you weren't crazy. And so, so what happens on Kickstarter? You get the design up there on Kickstarter, you're happy
Yeah,
with it. What happened?
so when I arrived on Kickstarter, there was something that I had which was incredibly powerful when I arrived there. So Kickstarter is a crowdfunding platform, and the way that that works is I, as a Kickstarter project creator, say, okay, I'm going to give myself 30 days to raise a set amount of money. And if I get pledges from enough people to make that money, then I'm allowed to take that money and do what I promised I would do with it. The way that crowdfunding on Kickstarter works is that essentially people are pre-ordering your product. They don't buy equity in your company or anything like that. It's literally a pre-order of an idea that they hope will exist. And in my case, 1,091 people, most of whom I did not know, said, "We don't know who you are, but you seem to be onto something. And for some reason, we think you're actually going to be able to do this." So 1,000 people backed my project. And in the 30 days, I managed to raise £62,000, which, as it turned out, was not enough to cover my costs because I'd had zero idea how much it was really going to cost. But the point is, I got the money together to be able to make my first production. And that was a vital first step.
Wow. So you raised enough money. So you had a, and again, how many people actually pledged?
1,091.
1,091 people on that Kickstarter campaign. So that's got to be pretty satisfying, especially in a crowded category. Like, there are a lot of backpacks out there people
There's
could
a lot of
buy.
backpacks, and people, what I was showing them was a not finished prototype. I realized when I was suddenly faced with my potential customers for the first time, even though I think I can communicate well, I had no idea how much information I really needed to give about this product for them to understand it. It was all caught up in my head, and a lot of that process was just knowing how to communicate what I had created for other people. And I'm still struggling with that, actually. Like, how do you really get across this new thing in a way that people can grasp? But there was a reason that people had actually engaged with what I was doing in advance, and that's during the prototyping phase, which had been about 4 months. I had come up against like little issues that I just didn't know the answer to. What color should this bag be? Like, what size laptops do people even use? Like, I knew what I wanted, but I didn't know what everyone else on the planet would want. And so what I did was used SurveyMonkey, which is a free survey tool, and just wrote down three questions that I had that day. And shared it on social media and said, "Hello, people, I'm sort of doing a thing. Can you just answer these questions about your travel habits, please? And I promise you, I will share in 6 months what I'm doing." And what they did was not only respond to these surveys with real live data, like this wasn't from a report that someone had done a year ago about the state of the backpack market. This was the most live data you can get from real travelers, admittedly quite a small number. So the first survey I did, I think about 15 people took it. Second survey I did, because they could see that I was trying to build something here, people shared it more and more, and about 100 people took it. Third survey, 300 people, and the final survey, like 1,000 people took it. They didn't all back the bag, but it was without me realizing live data to be able to prototype with. And it was marketing in a way that people felt ownership of what I was making because they were actually providing data for it. And that whole concept is wrapped up in actually the name of the company, Riot, which stands for Revolution in User Thinking. And it comes back again and again and again in everything I do because I'm just going around and I go around, I make something, I get feedback, I create it again, I get feedback, and I just keep going around in this circle. So this Revolution in User Thinking theme comes back again and again.
When did you ship the first backpacks? You actually get them in hand and send them to customers?
First thing, after the Kickstarter campaign, I actually had to manufacture them, or I had to get on a plane to China, and get these things made. And I had no concept of how long that would take. And actually, for my production runs, it takes like 3 or 4 months. And it takes 30 days for them to come back on a freight ship. So I was really learning that these are big timescales in comparison to what consumers are used to. So I headed out there and I found that, as a consumer, you kind of expect everything to be perfect when it's made because what you're presented with in shops is just row after row of pretty much perfect products. And I couldn't believe it when I was at the factory that so many of the bags had problems with them. I felt angry at the time because I just couldn't handle it. But really, what I needed to learn was manufacturing something is an incredibly, it's a process of attempting to allow enough time to really make a high quality product. So I tried to check as many of the bags as I could, but I hadn't left enough time to do it. So when they came back to the UK, so they came back, 200 of them came back in February 2015. That's when the first ever riot bags existed, were complete and existed. And the rest of them came back in May 2015. When they actually landed, I went into a warehouse with a friend and we went through every single riot bag and checked every zip and every seam before they went to the customers. And I just couldn't believe how many had problems. And what I learned from that, and this is what I've done in every single production run, every one of the 12 production runs since, is I check every single bag. I just take a couple of weeks at the end of every production and I check every single bag. And there are still some errors in the bags, which kill me, but it's actually impossible to get 100% quality control, I have found. Or maybe it is possible. I'm gonna try. But yeah, so they shipped in at the beginning of 2015, basically.
So you, this is another thing that I found amazing when we talked. You inspect each and every Riot bag, even to this day, personally. And are you comfortable giving us a rough number on how many Riot bags that is?
There are 18,000 in the world.
18,000.
But remember, if when I check a bag, let's say it takes between 2 minutes, and if there is a problem, I might have to sit down and talk to the director of the production line for 10 minutes. We might have to argue about what the problem is. So some bags that have problems, I'm not kidding you, about 30, maybe even 40% of the bags, the first time that I check them, have got problems. If, let's say, 30 or 40% of those bags have got problems, that means I need to check them at least once more. So by the time I've actually, let's say I've actually checked, I've probably spent about 3 months doing nothing other than checking riot bags. And you might think I'm crazy and that I should get a company to do this, but you wouldn't believe how much I learn as someone who was not a professional backpack designer.
Or may I add, not a professional designer or manufacturer of
Sorry, yeah.
anything, right? No, you'd never done any design
Not
or
a professional
manufacturing.
anything. In fact, I think the only professional thing I'd ever been until that point was perhaps a professional classical singer, but that was from a previous life.
I'm sure you've done nice things professionally and that you're a very accomplished person, obviously. But just in product design and manufacturing, it's pretty rare that somebody comes into it with no background. But on the other hand, that allows you to be maximally creative in your not only your design, but how you manufacture and how you run your business. That's just as cool as the products you make and just as refreshing for those of us who come out of sort of normal corporate life to hear your story of being one person checking every item, just kind of going with your gut and doing such cool things.
It definitely is going with my gut. And I think that's the special thing about running your own company. You get to do it with exactly your character. The way that you are is imprinted into every process in that company. And people, I think from a design perspective, precisely because I haven't had a background in design, I really cherish my checking of all of these backpacks, all of these riot bags, because from a learning perspective, designing a concept like the riot bag is really just designing one thing. And that is a complex process, but it is one thing. But manufacturing that concept and doing that 1,000 or 18,000 times is such a different task. And I had no idea. I think consumers, when they see, let's say, a kettle or a guitar or whatever it is that they're seeing that they see more than one of, I don't think when I was a consumer, I really understood that these were separate items that could have had their own problems and could have had their own little journey of being manufactured. Each riot bag, it is the concept that I designed, but each one has to be made individually and can have its own faults. There could be 50 problems with one bag, just randomly, and there could be no problems or one problem on the next bag. And I get immediate feedback from that moment where I check the bag because I can see where the manufacturing weaknesses were in my design. What about my design was making it harder to manufacture that product? Could I achieve the same outcome for the customer, but manufacture it in an easier way so that we don't have so many errors in that particular way? It's all these sort of things that I get out of the checking process.
It's interesting. You're learning a lesson that so many pros know well, so many of our listeners know, of course, about design for manufacture, and they well know that each item, believe me, they well know that each and every item can have its own problem when manufactured, and avoiding those problems through design strategy. You're learning the concepts that pros use. Hey, I wanted to ask you, you've come out with a whole series of Riot bags, not just one design. Why did you come up with so many variations and new designs? What was driving you, and where are you going in the future?
Well, the first ever Riot bag was that necessary first step just to get this idea out there, just to create this function that I believed would make people not just be safer, but actually feel safer. And that was what was my driving motivation. So I created this thing that I had this perfect concept in my head, and it was created and it worked, but it wasn't perfect. And I couldn't believe it. What was actually going to have to, in fact, I mean, I could believe it, but what I thought was, okay, what I want, what I crave is feedback from my users. And I wanted to know, did it work? Like, what was good, what was bad? And even just using it myself, I could see that there were things that needed to be improved in it. But it was that first one was just the necessary first step to like throw the idea out of my head and get it into 3D in the real world. And from that point onwards, it could start developing. And sometimes people say to me, hey, Sarah, so what are you going to redesign next? What are you going to reinvent next? And the boring answer is, I'm going to keep slowly and incrementally developing the backwards backpack because I actually believe this is the future of backpacks.
I, for one, I know I'm joined by a lot of listeners and your customers. I can't wait to see what you come up with next. I'm hoping that when the bag that grows to the large size is back in stock, I'm planning to get one, and I hope to run into you next year at Develop 3D Live, where I'll be traveling with just my Riot bag, which is the way I like to travel, actually, is single bag travel. I also want to add that as much time as you've given us, you've been a very generous guest with your time, and you've told us a lot. I think there's a lot of your story that we haven't had time to cover, and I know I wanted to point listeners to your website. Again, it's Riot, RIUT.co.uk. And on that site, in addition to all the products that you can choose to order or see the future ones coming along, there's also a page that is the Riot Bag Story, which is a really cool, timeline infographic of major events in your life and the evolution of Riot. We didn't have time to cover all the events, and I didn't know if you even wanted to, but I think listeners would find it a really cool timeline view of you and the amazing work you're doing at Riot. And so, Sarah, I want to thank you for joining us today on Masters of Engineering. You are a refreshingly energetic and innovative kind of product designer. While you've learned the craft without a lot of formal training or experience, you've certainly learned it very well. And I hope that all of us can take lessons from you in your passion for great design, your passion for quality, and the way you run your business, where you're still the only employee. Big thanks to Sarah for joining us from Riot. And I want to let everyone know that Masters of Engineering podcast, cool products, the people who develop them, and how they do it. Join us again for a future episode. I'm John Hirschtick. Thank you.